Okay, get started here. I'm going to find out who George is today. Solve that mystery. How many did their homework this week?
Okay. Huh?
Well, you know, you're the second person that said that to me. I don't know if they knew something over in Tiscawa, but I had a number of people come up and say something about the George afterwards. They had it figured out who he was. And I don't know if that was from my last clue or if it was from, I mentioned that same clue at the very beginning of the sermon. But anyway, picking up from where we were last week, I guarantee that we will understand who George is before we leave here today. Because like it or not, George has had an impact on each of our lives. We don't realize that. But I can guarantee you that he has. For instance, most of us in this room, we get classified by when we were born. You've all heard of the baby boomers and the baby busters. That all has to do with when you were born. And it really started with that group probably born after 1930 up through the end of the Second World War. That's a group known as the Greatest Generation. My group, and probably for many of the folks in this room too, although you may belong to the Greatest Generation as well. But anyway, my group, they decided it should be beginning in 1946 and going through 64. I was born in November of 45, so I put myself into that group. Although I should be a part of the Greatest Generation and not the baby boomers, but we're talking about a couple of months here. Well, that group of people that were behind my age group, now that's the group that were born between 1965 and 1985, they're known as the baby busters. But there's also the Generation Xers, the Generation Ys, and I wasn't terribly familiar with the Ys. And then we're living in the age of the millennials right now. But the baby busters, now that's the group born between 65 and 85. And this is surprising. They are the first generation in the Western world since about AD 1000 to begin life with a majority of their generation, a majority in some religious tradition other than Christianity. Isn't that a surprising figure? That more than 50% of that generation have embraced probably what we were talking about last week, that buffet of beliefs. They've gone to the table and they've taken what they wanted to take, and they've left the rest there. And they've created in their own minds a sense of their own belief system. And it's, to me, it's just amazing that that figure could be accurate. But they have grown up with this regular mixing of the concepts of God, of understanding, of morality, and how it might interfere somehow with God and his plans. Or they have embraced the rhetoric and the metaphor and the symbols representing and engaging God. In other words, they've, in a sense, created their own gods from all of this mixture that we're surrounded with. Now understand, we live in a multicultural society here in the United States, and most of the Western world is that. If you were to go to Western Europe, you would find a great number of people from African countries, from India. I grew up with a great number of Indians and Pakistanis that I remember in Scotland after the Second World War. But anyway, many of these baby busters feel that we'd all be just a little bit better off if we could simply commit ourselves, at least publicly anyway, to decency without too much doctrine. In other words, they think that we Christians tend to trip over ourselves in declaring the doctrines that we believe. But part of the problem is, how do we act toward all of those other religions and the adherents of those religions? Now, if the exclusive claims of the gospel are true, and you've heard me proclaim from this very pulpit that very position time after time after time, then we really need to consider how to react to all of those other religions around us. Now, if we say the beliefs of the Christian faith are true, then what happens to all those others? They can't all be true. There has to be something that is true and something that is manufactured. Well, that creates a problem for us. It compounds for us Christians when we consider the current posture of our culture, with more than ever before us as a live and let live society in which we do all live. The idea that you don't attack someone else's religion, and you even don't promote your own. And you think about all of those times that I've tried to send you out into this little village here and take the gospel with you, I've said. Well, there's a certain sense in which what you're going to encounter is not just someone who is void of any belief, but someone that someplace have put together a belief system for themselves that they can live with. And when we go out and want to spread our understanding of Christianity, we very often are going to be rebuffed and pushed back on. So that live and let live idea states that all religions are similar in their essential makeup, and that it is only with a certain sense of arrogance that one will assert that one religion might have a leg up on another religion. See, this, of course, is that non-confrontarian position that I talked about last week. We dare not get in somebody's face and begin to argue. And I'm not suggesting that I ever wanted to send you out to get into people's faces. That's not what I'm saying here. But when we do that, when we say that we have the truth is to be found in the gospel of Jesus Christ, that's nothing but arrogance to most people that would hear us. What would have happened now if Paul, remember he's in the city of Athens, what if he had preached this doctrine? O men of Athens, he would have said, I see that in every way you are very religious, and I think that's great. And I'm here this morning to commend you, to encourage you to continue on the path that you're on. But see, Paul didn't preach that. Paul understood that there was a God who created everything. And that same God looked at mankind and saw the sin that had but was a part of his life. And in order to save mankind from that sin, sent his only son here to die on our behalf. In other words, God was paying the price for the offense towards God. You see, he didn't preach the way I just said to the Athenians. But he surrounded himself in that city with all of these deities. And eventually he even came to that one, to the unknown God. And he says, this is the God that I want to talk to you about today. He took their own makeup and he used it to preach the gospel to them. So he clearly distinguished between what we would call the one true God and all of those other pretenders that he encountered in Athens. So what I'm saying today is that Paul didn't preach this way, and there's no way that we should preach this way either. But here's where things get rather complex. There is a gigantic segment of our culture that does hold to a certain doctrine, though few would use such a narrow term as doctrine. It sounds like it's clipped off at both ends and stuck in the middle somehow. Allow me to quote at length from a screenwriter. His name is Brian Godawa, and he's speaking on this subject. It's a rather long quote, but I think we need to hear it all. He says this: as C.S. Lewis pointed out, the most dangerous ideas in society are not the ideas that are being argued, but the ones that are assumed. Ideas debated in the public square are shaped by the very argument, but ideas that are assumed by the public eventually shape us. There are a few places, for example, where this power, or there are few places where this power is more effectual than in contemporary culture of American film. Keep that in mind now. He says, behind the veil of every entertaining movie is a value system that is being communicated through the story. The power of story is the power to catch a viewer up into that worldview through intriguing characters, interesting plots, and emotional connections. The worldview of a movie is the set of beliefs about how the world is and how it ought to be. Story is a powerful means of conveying a worldview because it doesn't preach or debate its values. It simply embodies them in the drama of the character's choices and consequences, and before we know it, we have acculturated to its vision of reality. I hope you were able to keep up with that, but basically he's saying that so much in our culture is, it comes to us, comes to our people through what is shown on that big screen at the movies. See, to an extent that I think many of us are unaware, and particularly that of people our age and younger, the American understanding of God has been dramatically influenced over, say, the past 40 or 45 years by one particularly gifted storyteller. And I'm speaking of filmmaker George Lucas. And I'm sure some of you had him figured out this past week. Like the Apostle Paul speaking in the Areopagus long, long ago, this man walked into the most public arena of American life, and he repeated a tale that has literally captured the imaginations of millions and millions of people, not only in the United States, but around the world. These are people who hunger for a worldview that to them makes some spiritual sense of all the various myths and gods that appear to be out there. The world is full of myths. The world is full of these imaginary gods. Now, let's understand that Lucas is no longer making movies. He retired after his sixth Star Wars film, but he has sold his creation to the Disney Company, and they have committed to making an additional six movies. Lucas made the first six, understand that. He's the one that planted so many of these ideas into the minds and hearts of the American people. But you see, his ideas today are still so popular, they are still so exciting, that even though he isn't working himself in the film industry, his gospel tends to live on. Now, gospel, I'm using it as good news. And that's how people view his films. They often, even though there's all these battles going on and there's the evil and the good, but they often present themselves in the end with a warm, fuzzy feeling because the good guys, the ones that are wearing the white hats, tend to win in the end. So anyway, understand that the tale that he's told this whole Star Wars business. And I'm trying to think, the first three movies in the Star Wars series were in one time frame, and then the next three went back to look at where the first three came from. Does that make sense? Am I saying that right? But anyway, they looked back. You saw Luke Skywalker as a grown-up young man in the first movie, but by the fourth movie, they went back to see not only where he came from, but where his father, who turns out to be Darth Vader, of course, but we understand where he came from as well. Now, much of Lucas's Star Wars appears to overlap with the Christian message, and at some point, it actually does. But we will soon see that the God of Scripture that we will particularly encounter next week and the God of the Star Wars are very, very different entities. What do they call God in the Star Wars movies? Anybody know? We talked about the Force. May the Force be with you. And that was an invisible presence, but it was a real presence to the people that were talking about it. And all these Jedi warriors, they knew all about the Force. Now, dozens of objective indicators point to a resurgence of reflection, and particularly reflection on spiritual matters in our society, which in some sense accounts for the ready acceptance of Lucas's ideas. Though his fascination fixes not on one particular God so much as upon an almost dizzying array and a huge assortment of religious viewpoints. See, Lucas took these things from when he was a child. In this context, we have already entered into this age of buffet belief. And you can go out there and find a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of this one and put them all together and essentially create your own belief system, your own religion, if you will. And it'll be different from the person who's sitting next to you today. Those of you that are sitting by yourselves, just imagine there's somebody else here. The Force is there. So what happens is that when people no longer feel bound to eat what has been set before them by one religious tradition, we as Christians, people are stocking their plates and they're bringing this personal piety with beliefs selected from a literal smorgasbord of religions and philosophies that are available to everyone today. So those people are less interested in whether these various beliefs form a rational and a balanced theological diet rather than the ones that just appeal to us. And I hope you understand that the majority of the people in this town have some religious belief. Most of them, and you've told me this, most of them, if they had to take a survey and say, what is your church, would say this. The Congregational Church on the corner is my church. Although most of them probably have never set foot, not once, inside this building. But you see, they would have an understanding that the God of this church would be one among many gods, small g, and that they could pick and choose where that goes. Pam and I were just talking the other night. There's an understanding about angels that is very prominent in our world today, in this country. First thing says, when you die, you become an angel. Okay? Now, that's not true at all. The other thing is that angels somehow come and go and are involved in our lives in a way that God never intended. But we place them there because it sounds good. It sounds appealing. It sounds warm and fuzzy to be surrounded by angels when we're in trouble, particularly. But our culture, very much like ancient Athens, is increasingly entering into this non-contrarian system on religious matters. We've already got the buffet of beliefs. We've got this non-contrarian, don't get in somebody's face about your faith. So many people are quite realistically horrified by the violence that has been done in the name of Christianity, and I don't blame them. Even today, that goes on. You think violence done by Christians was back in the Middle Ages when they were going off. But think about a Muslim moving into your neighborhood. Think about that situation. This is a few years ago now, but that situation in New York where they wanted to build a temple. What do they call a Muslim? A mosque. And it was sort of in downtown New York. And people went crazy. They were picketing the site. They were doing all sorts of terrible things simply because they were prejudiced against the Muslims. And they didn't want those Muslims coming into their neighborhood. It's no different than when the Christian church many years ago was against black people, and some still may be today. I remember when my brother-in-law's uncle, who was a Catholic priest, they were involved in, one of his people was involved in a big accident on the Dan Ryan Expressway. They were on the south side of Chicago, maybe into the suburbs down south. But the one thing they didn't want, it was a white man that aided a black man in this big accident on the Dan Ryan. And the one thing the people didn't want was black people coming into their neighborhood, because they had already fled one neighborhood in Chicago to get away from the blacks and had gone to this south suburb and said, we don't want any more blacks. We've moved away. We've bit the bullet, but we don't want them down here. That is violence done in the name of Christianity. We think it doesn't happen, but it happens in this country every single day. So the passionate pursuit, the public preaching of absolute truth, is really giving way in our culture to a more moderated and a privatized religion. You may be the only one that understands your own personal beliefs. Universal truth is being dismissed in favor of my truth and your truth. And those two truths can stand side by side, but we will never confront each other about the differences in them. So like the Apostle Paul in the first century of Athens, an articulate new evangelist has stridden across the hilltop of public discourse in our time. Film director and producer George Lucas has proclaimed a gospel that speaks to many people who are very religious in their interests, but who, like the Athenians of old, have been reluctant to commit themselves to one particular God or one particular spiritual way. Now, am I preaching to the audience here? Or do you understand and agree with what I'm saying? Because I really think that as you go out into the world and you take your Christianity with you, these are the things that you will encounter. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But if you've never thought about what this society that we live in, how it's made up, then you might be surprised. You might even be shocked at discovering how divergent the belief system in our world is. Now, here's the thing that I discovered in some of my research. Lucas was a disciple of a fellow by the name of Joseph Campbell. He was a philosopher, or more commonly was called a mythologist. And he wrote a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. But primarily what Lucas garnered from Campbell was the idea that beneath all of these various religions of history, there lay a common set of spiritual stories. And that's where this hero with 1,000 different faces came from. He was one person, but he could have had any one of thousands of different understandings and worldviews. Now, each of those worldviews pointed to a dimension that reaches far beyond our present reality. It can be a meeting ground for everyone who holds a religious interest. It's like I said last week, Oprah Winfrey claims to be a spiritual person, but she's not religious, she says. In other words, she's freely admitting that she's not a Christian. She doesn't hold to Christian beliefs. They may be a part of her belief system in her own spirituality, but she would not consider herself a follower of Jesus Christ. Now here's what Lucas had to say. He said, "I set out to make a movie for a generation without fairy tales, a generation who, like me as a child, wondered, if there's only one God, why are there so many religions? I see Star Wars as taking all of the issues that religion represents and trying to distill them down into a more modern and easily accessible construct. I wanted it to be a traditional moral study, to have some sort of palpable precepts in it that children could understand. There is always a lesson to be learned. And traditionally, we learn these lessons from church, from family, and art. But in the modern world, we get them from the media, from the movies." And I think that's just an amazing quote, but it sums up what he believed when he wrote the first Star Wars script. And so if we go back to the mid-70s, and I can remember taking one of our girls, everybody else was out of town except this one daughter and myself, and we went to see in 1977 the first of the Star Wars movies. And we were enthralled by it. Have you seen the Star Wars movies? Well, wait and see what your homework assignment is for this week. But anyway, Lucas began to collect from this buffet of beliefs and all of the stuff that was out there. And he drew on themes from both Christianity and Zen Buddhism, from Hinduism, and from many of the New Age traditions as he compiled each one of them into a part of a new gospel for the children of the postmodern age. And the result of his thinking is this story that we call Star Wars, which by the time it's finished, and it may not be finished at 12 films, and that's remarkable, but that's what is a product of his mind that came out of the mind of Joseph Campbell. It is an epic tale spreading across Lucas's 6 episodes and the promise of 6 more, and I think we're 3 into them now, from the Disney Corporation. But along the way, Lucas has really wrestled with some of the great moral and spiritual themes of history. And he often brought forth lessons that, at least on the surface, sure seem to square with the Christian worldview. The good guys always win, no matter what. And it's carried to an extent that is too rarely found in modern films today. Sometimes the bad guys win in other modern movies. But keep in mind that while the Christian message often appears in modern cinema, it too often becomes fragmentary and distorted at best. And that's the way we put together by selecting from our buffet of beliefs. We get a little piece of Christianity and a little piece of some other religion. And we put them all together and you distort the whole thing either way. For example, Lucas literally blows apart this modern idea, the Enlightenment idea, that views education and technology can be that which brings forth a brighter future. You know, 150 years ago, as the Enlightenment began to come forward, they believed that the more you educate people, that is the solution to all of society's problems. He depicts life as a struggle between good and evil. And surprisingly, you've got Darth Vader all dressed in black and Luke Skywalker very often dressed in white, or at least off-white. And when you see them struggling together on the screen, it becomes evident that this is the struggle between good and evil. He honors the importance of friendships and loyalty, and he recognizes that the small decisions, the minor decisions that we make in life, ultimately shape our destiny. So at its core, Star Wars is about the power of a sense of call. And you've heard me speak of that so many times, how God calls each one of us. It's a matter of discovering who you are and where you come from. It's about temptation. It's about the fall of man. It's about grace and regeneration. All of those are Christian themes. And Lucas has woven those themes into his story along with other religious understandings. It's about heroes that come in unlikely packages and whose most heroic trait is often their willingness to make that leap of faith, that leap of self-sacrifice. In other words, to give up my life for the benefit of helping someone else. Now, there can be absolutely no doubt in anyone's mind about the impact of the work of George Lucas. Since its debut in 1977, the total Star Wars franchise revenue, I get this, has been a staggering $42,850,000. And those aren't old figures. That is taken up to the 17th of December of last year. With every episode, Lucas has redefined the state of the art in special effects. He's redone technology many times over. And I would suggest he has also redefined the power of contemporary cinema to influence a spiritual vision. Now, I know that that last statement is hard for many of us 50 and above to fully grasp. That's not the world that we understand. But understand that those that are primarily younger than us take their understandings from contemporary movies. So allow me to elaborate, if I could. Only a few years ago, CNN carried the results of a national poll taken on people who were ages 17 to 34 at the time. They would be the baby busters and the Gen Xers, I suppose, too. But that's the group that I spoke of earlier. In this study, the respondents were asked to identify their top five heroes in all the world. At number five was Martin Luther King Jr. It's a great pick. Number four, Mother Teresa. Both of those now gone from us, but they wouldn't be selected today, I don't think. At number three, Michael Jordan. Do you remember Michael Jordan? Sure you do. Today that one might be either Stephen Curry or LeBron James. But the idea that my favorite hero is a sports hero. At number two, Jesus Christ. But number one for people in this age group was someone called Luke Skywalker. And that is incredible. He was the lead character in the early Star Wars movies. Keep in mind that this poll was taken about 20 years ago, so obviously those people were still in the forefront. And some of these heroes might be replaced if you were to do the same survey today. But I'm sure if this poll were taken at this moment, that we would have similar results today. That the idea that these people who have come to us through the art of cinema have influenced our lives to the point that we see Luke Skywalker as being more important or higher up on the chain of heroes than is Jesus Christ. Now, interestingly, this same group of respondents considered the release of the first Star Wars movie the most defining moment of their lives. And it ranked just behind the explosion of the space shuttle Challenger, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the conduct of the first Gulf War. So overall, the influence of George Lucas and that which he has had in the past has been absolutely extraordinary. Yet we, at our age, tend to let that pass us by. People don't often give credit to Lucas as having had the sort of spiritual and the philosophical influence that he has really had. But you see, here's where it becomes a problem for us Christians. If we don't come to understand that Lucas and others who have followed him have the ability to influence our culture, they have the ability primarily to influence our children, and if we don't get our hands on that and understand where our children and our grandchildren's ideas come from, then I think the church is doomed. It's doomed to fail in the next generation or two. Now, as I said, next week we will wrap up this series before I begin my Lenten preaching. Although it's going to be a bit disrupted with three Sundays in the middle coming out. But I will begin to preach a series. So if you feel like it, here's going to be your homework assignment. And it won't be quite as important as reading Acts 17. But I would invite every one of you to go to the movie store. You can go to that Family Video up in just south of Walmart there. And rent one or more of the first six, preferably one and two maybe, of the first Star Wars movies. And hopefully you have a DVD player at home or even an old tape player. I think do they still have tapes up there? Probably not. But if you've got the way of looking at this, you could even look at it on a computer if you don't have something to play it on the big screen. But I want you to take a look at least one of those films in light of what we have talked about these last couple of weeks and see if it opens up a whole new way of thinking for you. I want you to begin to understand how much influence those movies have had on us. And let me say, may the God of the universe continue to guide and to bless you. Amen.